Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, West Country busking band Fat Bollard. And on the China crisis, Professor Steve Keen, the economist. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. We start this week with The Supernatural, and it's Vince McCann, that's MCCANN, on another programme, another podcast called The Mind Renewed, which is run by Julian Charles. And here is Vince McCann being interviewed by Julian Charles.
I came across the paranormal initially, things like ghosts, UFOs, and became quite intrigued by that. But this soon led me into occultism. First of all, it was hypnosis and then books on witchcraft. And it just got darker and darker, really. And in the end, I was calling upon demons and spirits from a book which I had, which was a grimoire, which is quite a dark book of occultism. And I was making connections with these beings. Eventually, I got in contact with a girl who had some real problems, and at first I just thought they were mental health problems, but eventually it became apparent that this girl was possessed by spirits, and the spirits spoke through her using a male voice. She could perform supernatural feats, such as create light orbs would appear. She could influence people. She had ability to foresee things as well that did come to pass. She had supernatural strength. She foamed at the mouth. There was multiple personalities as well. And this is all quite interesting because later I'm going to become a Christian. And I looked at the accounts in the Gospels where Jesus dealt with the demonized. This is exactly what I found. And I had very little knowledge of the Bible or Christianity or God, although I always did believe in God. But quite confused about who he was. When I become a Christian, when I got away from this girl and got away from the occults, I was just amazed. When I read the Gospels, foaming at the mouth, supernatural strength, multiple personalities, Jesus met a man called Legion because there was many demons in him. It made so much sense to me, really. Wow, this fits exactly what happened to me. And I even had demons cast out of myself as well. Amazing as it sounds. One morning at the front of a Pentecostal church, I got some prayer. This was in front of around about between 300 to 500 people. As I got prayed over, I hit the floor and slithered across the floor like a snake at speed, winding back and forth. And a voice was coming out of me that I had no control over. And it was using my vocal cords, and I was underneath screaming, "Help, help." And this thing was laughing and screaming, and I could feel its emotions. It was mocking the pastor. It was mocking the congregation. And the pastor came over, and he prayed, and he was trying to cast this thing out in the name of Jesus. And I could feel this force coming down from the pastor as he said the name Jesus. And eventually the spirit was expelled. But I had other problems as well. I mean, it continued for a little while after that, and similar things occurred. But again, in the Bible, spirits were cast out by Jesus, and as believers now, we have the authority in Christ to cast out these spirits in the name of Jesus. So I experienced that firsthand. It was quite amazing. It's not just Christians that speak about the dangers of the Ouija board. I mean, I've spoke to a lot of pagans and neo-pagans and occultists on YouTube in the past and on the internet in general. And sometimes we can be accused of using Christian propaganda and just trying to scare people. But it's not just Christians who are warning about this. There's occultists and spiritualists as well who are warned about it. And even people with no real religious belief will warn against it. And even if they don't recognise it as being spiritual in nature, they'll warn against the psychological dangers of what happens, because there's just too many stories that have come out where people have been seriously damaged in one way or another by the Ouija board. I've got a quote here. It's a book on the occult called The New Encyclopedia of the Occult, John Michael Greer. and it's on page 351, and it says, under the entry for Ouija, says, there are enough accounts of psychic and spiritual trouble that began with Ouija experimentation, though, that definite caution may well be appropriate. As with any means of interacting with the subtle planes of being, Ouija should not be treated as a game or a toy. End quote. It goes on, but I mean, that's the relevant part of the quote I'd like to get across. Because as you mentioned earlier, this is being promoted as a toy. Parker Brothers, Hasbro are producing it as a toy. You can get this thing on Amazon. You can get a pink Ouija board for young girls. Obviously, it's aimed at young girls. Who else would want a Barbie pink, pretty looking Ouija board? And there's the glow in the dark one for boys as well. I mean, this encyclopedia on the occult says it's not a toy. It's not a toy. This is not a Christian source that's saying this. There was different forms of the Ouija board that existed in Greece and in the ancient world, well before it was even marketed as a game, but there's different versions of it. But yeah, it seemed to really take off just after the First World War, when I think a lot of people were eager to try and get in touch with dead relatives, and they thought that this was a good way of doing so. Mm. But some of the things that have resulted in the Ouija board, going back to some of the bad experiences, a lot of people, of course, are familiar with the story of The Exorcist, the film, and where the young girl is possessed by spirits, and it's quite horrific, really. The film is a horrendous film, and I wouldn't particularly advise anyone to watch it because it is so traumatic, the film that was made in the 70s. But not everyone seems to realise that that story is based on real events that did occur. Rather than being a young girl, though, it was a young man who began to... First of all, they began to hear scratching and noises around the house. And then eventually the young man was taken over himself and started to speak with another voice, and all kinds of horrific paranormal phenomena occurred. And of course, people tried to perform exorcisms on this young man. But prior to all this, a Ouija board was actually used. The boy was apparently given the Ouija board by an aunt who was a spiritualist, a lady called Harriet. She was the one that introduced him to the Ouija board because he showed some interest in it. This was in the 1940s, and you can look this up in a book by an author called Thomas B. Allen in his book Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism. But also as well, I don't know how many of our listeners, Julian, are familiar with the Enfield poltergeist story here in England in the 1970s. I find this an absolutely fascinating case.
I know nothing about it, so please do tell us.
Oh, yeah. Wow. It's been hailed as one of the best documented poltergeist accounts in history, really. And of course, it occurred in Enfield in the 1970s in England. A young girl by the name of Janet appeared to be at the epicentre of the paranormal activity. And she's since grown into a mature woman now in her 40s, and she still has horrendous memories of it. She very rarely gives interviews, but she has started to give some interviews just recently. The things that she says, she says she's ashamed of some of the stuff that happened because she felt as though she had no control whatsoever over a voice that spoke through her. And it was the voice of an old man. It's a very gruff, rasping voice. She started to speak in this voice, and the spirit claimed to be an old gentleman called Bill, who supposedly lived in the house prior to Janet and her family moving into it. Supposedly he was upset that this family had moved in. But all this activity started off because of a Ouija board involvement. If you go to the Daily Mail, you find that she's had an interview there. I mean, if you want to read the full article, it's really, really good. I'm only using the Daily Mail as a brief summary, really. I know what maybe a lot of listeners might not be too keen on the Daily Mail, but what it says, I mean, I'm very familiar with this account, and what it says is accurate. But there's a quote there from Janet, who is now a grown woman, saying, quote, that she admitted playing with a Ouija board with her sister just before the activity flared up at the home. So a Ouija board was involved there. It wasn't just the possession case. It was, again, like the Exorcist story, there was all kinds of scratchings and rumblings around the house. It had lots of witnesses as well, this case. Over 30 credible witnesses all experienced all kinds of things. One was a police lady a WPC Caroline Heaps, who stated that she saw a large armchair move unassisted 4 feet across the floor. And she inspected the chair for hidden wires but couldn't find any explanation as to what she'd seen. There was journalists in the house. Some of them lived there. Some of the people that came, there were psychic investigators. They came to the house. They witnessed objects flying around. A journalist who went said that he'd heard about this and he went and he didn't expect to find anything too exciting. But he said as soon as they walked into the house, there was an air about the place and things were just flying around. He said he just couldn't believe what he was seeing. And this is a skeptic, this guy. He said he was hit in the head by a small piece of Lego or a marble, I think it was, that he said. But he said the thing is, these things that were flying around, when you picked them up, they were hot as well. On another occasion, a large fireplace, metal fireplace, was pulled out of the wall in another room. When the investigators went to hear what the noise was, they saw this fireplace pulled out. Nothing that the children could have done. It was just, you know, too much of a heavy item for them to deal with. And Janet even claimed to have levitated as well. Her parents would wake up in the night to banging and they'd find her on the floor screaming and she'd claim to have been flying up in the air. And a lollipop lady who was outside said that she actually witnessed this herself. She saw Janet, amazing as it sounds, she said she saw Janet flying around the room with all kinds of objects accompanying her.
That was an extract from The Mind Renewed, which is an online podcast by Julian Charles. And he was there interviewing Vince McCann.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, the markets around the world had many crises since 2008, and many of us are looking back also at 1929, the crash in Wall Street, wondering what we can learn from that, if anything, and how that can inform what we're doing today. Anyway, I'm joined on the line now by Professor Steve Keane. Steve, could you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your experience in the world of economics?
Yep, okay, well, I'm currently head of School of Economics, History and Politics at Kingston University, London. And before that, I was at the University of Western Sydney and then University of New South Wales. What made me, distinguished me from other economists is I focused on the work of Hyman Minsky, starting back in 1987. And I've been building models of financial instability ever since. And that seems to be what the world has done in the meantime. So all my fellow colleagues were doing general equilibrium models of their own economies. And equilibrium is the last thing we've seen. But they're, of course, unable to consider the world in disequilibrium, but that's where I think it always is.
Let's get on and talk about the meat of the issue, which is trying to get our heads around what's been going on in China, because much of the commentary about the international economy seems to be sort of enveloped in a kind of gobbledygook that makes it difficult to know whether, as a listener, as a viewer, as a consumer of news, we can really trust what's going on. So what's your take?
Well, We never get to see the important information in most of the conventional media, because what tends to happen is journalists report what the bureaucrats and the economists in public service tell them and the banks tell them, and they all focus on the horrors and dangers and worries and scares of public debt and completely ignore the private banking system, because according to conventional economic theory, that doesn't matter. The standard argument is level of private debt is like a consenting act between adults. You know, what goes on in your bedroom shouldn't be anybody else's responsibility, doesn't affect them, therefore you shouldn't control it, ditto for private debt. In fact, that's completely wrong. Private debt's what drives the level of the economy. We've let it get out of control, and if you don't read about that and understand what's happening there, then you don't know what's going on.
Now, to what extent are the debt crises we've been having really in the noughties and in this decade, and particularly this latest one in China, is it about having a debt crisis? I mean, that was certainly what was going on in 2008, because there was a lot of loans that turned bad on the banks, and it may be that that was a deliberate thing. I mean, I can remember I was unemployed at the time, and I was offered a loan of £7,000-£8,000 by my bank, and I remember thinking, well, they know I can't pay that back.
Yeah, it's partly classic irresponsibility, because the banks themselves, you know, made money by extending loans. Their source, what they sell, is debt. So the more they sell of debt, the more money they make in the short term.
Now, where does the money come from for that?
Double entry bookkeeping. It's all it takes is if you go to a bank and if you took that loan on, if you went to the bank, they'd say, here, Tony, here's £8,000. And by the way, you owe us £8,000. So the very act of creating the loan creates the money and also therefore gives you the capacity to spend that money, which goes into the economy and causes additional demand. So that's the source of the bubbles we see is people borrowing money from banks, banks creating the money in the process, and that money becoming extra demand and extra income.
Now, if I was to start creating money, I would probably be called a counterfeiter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only people who've got the rights to create money in our systems are the banks and the government. And what people are aware of is the government's capacity to create money and think, well, they can't let that get out of control. This is where all the fetish about having a surplus comes from, the belief you've got to control government behavior. But they completely ignore bank behavior, and that's where the money creation comes from. In this sense, I find the general public's actually brighter about this than the economics profession, because conventional economists have convinced themselves of a model in which banks don't matter, whereas the private and they therefore ignore the capacity of banks to create money. Whereas people in the public, generally speaking, sort of think, okay, well, banks, you know, make money out of nothing. Well, they're quite right.
I mean, that's what you're saying there is pretty shocking, actually, that general public, people like you, no, actually not you, but I, understand things better than the academics. And that's really worrying. How the academics got themselves into a position, and I imagine you're including with that some of the financial journalists, that is to say the professionals who are supposed to understand it, don't. How's that come about?
It comes about because we're dealing with a very complex system. You're trying to understand the economy. You can't just stand outside it and take a look and work out what happens when you press this button and push that button. We make these analogies about treating it like a vehicle or like a control panel, but in fact, we live inside the system. So you've got to have a model in your mind that helps you understand it, or not helps you understand, but what you end up understanding is the model and not the system itself. And that's the dilemma that the financial journalists and, in particular, professional economists have got themselves into. They understand a model in which lending is between Steve and Tony. And therefore, in that model, if I borrowed money off you rather than, let's say I lent you the money rather than a bank, I'd give you 8,000 quid, which means I've got 8,000 quid less to spend. I'm going to cut back on my spending, whereas you increase yours, and one counterbalances the other. And that's the model that they teach. Paul Krugman calls it the model of loanable funds. And that's what they teach its students. They disparage anybody who criticizes that model, and basically the ones who survive an economics degree are the ones who swallow that model. Exceptions like me somehow squeak through the system, but that always seems to be the case.
Sounds like a kind of groupthink, Steve.
It's very much a groupthink, very much a groupthink. And it's quite amazing to go to an economics conference and see this groupthink happening. So anybody who thinks outside that is repelled from the group. You become an outsider. And if you're on the inside, you believe this model where banks, debt, and money don't matter. You leave them out of your model and think you understand capitalism. Well, the trouble is, whether you understand the system or not, it exists as it is, and it can knock you out of the water.
What you're implying here is that even the regulators have got it wrong, because I would have hoped, anyway, that badly performing banks, I mean, we've had criminality, of course, in banks as well, with the fixing of LIBOR, money laundering. I mean, there's a whole host of things they like to call mis-selling, but actually are fraud. Surely some of those banks would have had their licenses to print money taken away, that ability to counterfeit effectively taken away.
Well, no. And in fact, what's actually been happening is we've been preserving those banks and, you know, paying the executives to hang around and continue advising on how to do it. There's a real subservience from the political class towards the financial class. And in fact, the only bank I'm going to give any real kudos to happens to be the Bank of England, because the Bank of England's aware of this way in which money is created. And if you read popular publications by the Bank of England, you've got a much better idea of what happens in the monetary system than if you read the Federal Reserve, for example, in America.
Now, are you saying that, though, but the current governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, now he comes from the Bank of Canada, but also, very importantly, he was on a couple of key committees to do with international bank regulation at the Bank for International Settlements. So he's a regulator himself, effectively.
Oh, yeah, but I'm not saying necessarily Carney, but I'm saying inside the Bank of England, you've got a much wider range of views about how the money system works.
Okay, so what is the role of the BIS in Switzerland? Because I understand at the end of the Second World War, there were attempts to close it down because it had been helping the rise to power of the Nazis.
Well, in fact, it was there to handle the debt that the Nazis had. It's a complicated story, but the Bank of International Settlements was formed because in the lead up to the Second World War, before Hitler came to power, the German government had issued a large number of bonds to finance its programs, and they'd been sold largely to American investors. Then when the Depression hit, those American investors wanted their money back, and that's what caused a huge downturn in Germany, a huge crisis, a Great Depression, as bad as what they're doing to Greece right now. And the response of the German people was to vote the Nazis into power. And 4 months after he came to power, Hitler wrote off those debts, refused to pay them, which then meant that, of course, all the bondholders in America lost their money. Germany suddenly became free of debt, and the price of the bonds collapsed. Well, guess who bought the bonds back? The Nazis. So then to handle those debts after the war, that's why the BIS was formed. And then once that debt was repaid to the Americans after the Second World War, the Bank of International Settlements continued mainly as a talking fest for central banks. And that's been its role. It hasn't been particularly, it's not a central bank, it's not a clearinghouse for central banks, but it's a place where they come every 6 months to talk about the economy and public policy and so on.
But I know Mark Carney was on the committee which regulates central banking on the BIS. At least they attempt, from Switzerland, to regulate the way central banks operate. So
that's where the things like the Basel Accords, that's where the Basel Accords come from. And what you've got is some pretty policies set up which believe the banks can self-regulate, and we've seen how well that's worked. But at the same time, just by sheer chance, the Bank of International Settlements Research Department was headed by a brilliant Canadian, again, called Bill White. And Bill White was a great fan of Hyman Minsky's work. And Bill White was warning that a financial crisis was coming, in literally warning literally to the face of Greenspan for the 6 years or so before the crisis happened.
Now, what about what's been going on with China devaluing and other things like, for example, economic sanctions going on? It does seem like there's a kind of new form of warfare going on here where countries are able to actually make other countries hurt quite a lot using their economies.
Well, I mean, that's really been the basis of the euro, because Germany denies it, but Germany's benefited dramatically out of the euro by locking all the countries of Europe into a fixed exchange rate with it, which means that they can't devalue against a stronger economy. That's benefited Germany enormously. It's given it a huge part of its trade surplus. So now what you're seeing with China is that China is feeling a decline in its domestic demand because its rate of growth of private debt is slowing down, and they're partially trying to get out of it by trying to boost their export demand once more and reduce their import purchases. So, yeah, you have got economic wars going on through currency.
Is there any way that here in Britain that we, as a sovereign nation, supposedly, could defend against a crash, an international crash, to make it affect us less here? Because quite obviously many people, sensible people around the world, are thinking, well, if there is an international crash brought on by, problems in China and knock-on problems in Wall Street and London, etc., that they would want to mitigate against that. I mean, I'd use the analogy of, say, harbour defences or whatever, building those up against a tsunami. In a way, an international crash is almost like an economic tsunami.
Yeah, but the thing is, the only real defence you've got against that is having a strong export sector. And that's one thing England hasn't got. So the main weakness England faces as a nation is not its government deficit, it's its trade deficit. And that means that you've got to, you're running like 6% of GDP deficit. That weakens you dramatically in terms of competing with countries like China and Japan and Germany and Japan that are running large trade surpluses. And you have no real way of controlling them apart from devaluing your own currency.
Now, what about things like exchange controls? Because vast amounts of trillions of pounds and dollars can run around the world at the moment in seconds, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, the whole problem has been letting finance get out of control. It's, I think Keynes once said that finance is a good servant and a bad master. And what we've let happen is the financial sector has become the master of the global economy. And that is always a recipe for an economic crisis. Because banks make money by creating debt. You let them free and say, create as much debt as you like. They'll create too much debt for this system, and then it crashes when the debt burden gets too high. And we've seen that in Japan, we've seen it in America, and we're now seeing it in China.
Now, we've seen a lot of finger-pointing at China over the last couple of weeks. And that sort of implies that our economy is healthy. Is that the case?
No. You've actually just been through a bubble before China did. I'm looking at a graph right now of private debt to GDP, and of course, private debt's where all these things happen. It's not government debt that really matters, it's private debt. But England had a debt bubble that pretty much, you can say, began at the time of the Big Bang back in the 80s, slumped after the 1990s, and then from 1997 on, you had an increase in your private debt in England from 120% of GDP to 200%. That peaked in 2010. It's been heading down ever since. That's partly why the economy's been stumbling. What the Chinese have done is they had, starting until 1990, they had a pretty much constant debt ratio of about 100% of GDP. And then when the financial crisis hit, their solution was to tell their banks to lend like buggery to anybody with a pulse in China. And private debt in China went from being in 2008 being 100% of GDP, it rose to 180% at the beginning of this year. That's an 80% of GDP increase of debt in something like 7 years. It's the fastest rate of growth of private debt in human history, and that's what's caused the, in some ways, that underwritten demand in the rest of the global economy, because that extra debt was extra demand as well, and now that's come to an end. So it's, you know, whenever you have an out of control from central and financial system, it's great while the party's going, while the debt's being extended, but the hangover comes when you've got to pay it back.
So is there going to be an international crash in September?
Not necessarily, because it's been unwound. Like the levels have been of debt have been slightly unwound in the rest of the West, and they're now more like you've got the stagnation situation that Japan's been in. But there is a crash in China, and it's certainly by no means it's only just started in China.
Well, I really appreciate your take on all this, Steve. Where can we keep track of economic ideas and thoughts, which is outside this university and London media groupthink?
Well, my two ways to get hold of my stuff. One is through the column I write on Forbes magazine. So you can search me on Forbes and Steve Keen, and you'll find I've got a column on Forbes. And I've been writing, my last three stories this week have been about China. And I also have my own blog called debtdeflation.com/blogs. I'm afraid I made it a bit complicated there. But if you go there, you'll find both my Forbes articles linked and also videos and presentations I give on economics.
Okay, Steve Keen, author of Debunking Economics. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're welcome.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And we're joined in the studio now by busker musicians Fat Bollard and there's Patrick Shevlin and Adam Whittaker from the band joining us. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, I just spotted you on YouTube, and just by amazing coincidence and a bit of extra effort, I imagine, you've managed to make it in today. Can you tell us about how you decided to get together as a group, and a bit about your influences? Maybe you first, Patrick.
I had a disagreement with my girlfriend and went to my mate's house and said, come on, let's play some music in his kitchen. And then we jammed for a couple of weeks and then took the music to the streets.
Was it a sort of therapy for you, if you know, on the rebound?
I guess I wasn't on the rebound, still with the woman.
Oh right,
it's
okay.
All right with her, yeah. Good. We just had a disagreement. It's all right, we have lots of those
actually. So do you think that's a good healthy thing in a relationship, that sort of thing? Because some people get very upset and hurt, don't they, and walk out and things like that.
As long as you know you forgive them and love them, you can say what you want.
And did you manage to do that at all in your music? Do you do that?
Yeah. It's constant disagreements amongst us as musicians who are constantly on the road and singing in different towns and different streets. Lots of those disagreements are with council workers, though.
Tell us about that. Are the councils trying to stop you singing?
Well, in lots of places, the council doesn't like buskers.
Well, tell us where are good and bad places around the southwest then.
Oh, in the southwest of England, there's a problem at the moment with Padstow. They don't like bands on the bandstand.
So what's the bandstand for then?
Well, better ask the Padstow Council.
Maybe we will. So Padstow, but whereabouts do you actually get quite a good reception then?
Oh, we've had good reception from the tourists in Padstow. The tourists are great, and the they come and go and they.
So
buy
if you've
the
got
CDs.
A couple of council officials and 20, 30 tourists, how does that work?
Well, when you get a crowd of people asking the council worker to go away and leave the musicians to carry on, normally the Jobsworth council official walks away because it's easier.
So what sort of reasons do they give you that you're not allowed to do it?
Well, we haven't asked permission. That's normally
right. So the idea is you've got to get permission to sing.
I think supposed to across the country. That's the case. You're supposed to go to the council and get permission to play music or get a license.
What about whistling? Are you allowed to do that without permission?
I think it's a money related thing. I know you're not allowed to sell stuff without a trader's license. You need a different trader's license
actually,
for each different
you
area.
You're not actually selling, are you? People are offering you money. You're not actually charging for your song. So
it's true.
All sounds a little bit draconian. Anyway, Adam, what about you? What brought you to the band?
I was living in Calstock car park in my van at the time and had a banjo, and so I was invited along.
What sort of bands, groups and things like that have influenced you in the stuff you're doing now?
I don't know. None of that's very interesting. It's all my dad's old records. I haven't listened to music in ages. I've been living with no electricity for too long.
Yeah?
But, Bob Dylan and Van Morrison, stuff like that. Singer-songwriters that don't seem to exist anymore.
What's happened to music? Because certainly, I mean, we used to have things like Top of the Pops. We used to have quite a lively music scene, which you could latch onto and think, well, that's actually a great tune, and it's only just come out this week. That doesn't really seem to happen now, does it?
God knows, yeah. I don't know. It's all controlled by charts and...
I mean, it just seems to me, I mean, this is just my own total prejudice in this, to have gone from a place where talent was fostered, nurtured and thrust out to the public to a kind of factory where musicians, session musicians, lyricists, etc. are turned into a kind of musical machine in the factory and churned out.
Yeah, it's just been commodified like everything else. But I'm sure it still exists. It's out there. It's just somewhat more difficult to
so
find.
So what makes you guys different?
I don't know. We're more interested in busking than playing venues. Not a lot of bands seem to do that.
But what is it that attracts you to actually being out on the street there?
I like travelling, and seeing the country is good. And you get more money in the street than a venue can ever pay.
So you're saying that if, say, for example, you turn up at a venue, the venue will take maybe what you think... I'm putting words into your mouth here, but more than they should or more than their share?
Most pubs can't afford to pay the bands very much at all.
Maybe a few pints of beer or something.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Really?
Yeah.
So what about heckling and things like that? Because when you've got passers-by, you're much more likely to get that sort of thing than if people have come to actually see you in a gig.
The spontaneity of it is brilliant as well. You know, you're on the street where people don't necessarily expect to see a band, and that adds an exciting element to it rather than late night in a pub playing to a bunch of people who are there to see a live band. There's no spontaneity at all.
Let's launch in with a song, Big Car. What album's this from and what inspired that, Patrick?
Big Car is on the Shouting at Seagulls album, and my old man's got a big car and he doesn't use it for anything other than speed bumps in London, like lots of people.
Your big car, your big house, your big debt. Can you see how easily you forget? Poverty and misery, they don't go hand in hand. Your sorrows, your sickness, your self-indulgent sadness, I don't understand. Your sorrows, your sickness, your self-indulgent sadness, I don't understand. And I'm not into politics, I just know theft is wrong. The poor man is happy with his simple songs. Can you lift your eyes? Can you see the bright side? Is it all messed up behind the lies you try to hide? Or is it all messed up behind the lies you try to hide? What you do is what sake, is a little light out for you. Can you see the hope is all you have? And if you lose, you lose ourselves, we'll lose. I know as I have hope, I can cope with the sight of you. The grandchildren will one day pay for the things you do. The land of lies, the long drawn out fights over what is lost. Will you turn your tail and run away when you feel the cost? Stop before you flee, listen to me, I'm talking to you. The only thing you need is to feed on the simple things and true. The only thing you need is to feed on the simple things aren't true. Can you see the truth in what you do? Is what you see easily laid out for you. Can you see the hope is all you have? And if you lose ourselves, we lose.
Yeah, cheerful little song there, very political, and that's one of the things I miss political sort of protest music, protest song. Effectively, Patrick, it's really about money, is it? I mean, is that something that you're writing about there? Because we've got this big imbalance starting to open up. Well, I mean, I suppose over the last 10, 15, 20 years it's been opening up in Britain, but it's starting to get a bit nasty, isn't it?
What, the
imbalance between the rich and poor, I suppose?
Rich and poor. Well, it's massive, yeah. If I was really rich, then I could, and I shared some of that, like I was educated by my parents, then I would be able to help the people that were poor. And if the people that have more are inspired to want to help, then the balance would level out. But whilst there's so much greed is the problem, surely.
Well, yeah, and also people are, it's fear, isn't it? Because people are worried about the future, they're not sure about the future, you know, we're in the situation, we're being told on the news just the last week or so that the Chinese are devalued and there's shockwaves going through the stock markets and this sort of thing. People are afraid, and so they don't want to, they are kind of hoarding, aren't they?
Any decision or action based on fear or driven by fear is not going to have any positive outcome, and whether it be big business or wealthy individuals or wealthy countries, if we all stopped going for profit, and started helping the people that haven't got anything, then everything would level up.
Adam, have you got any sort of thoughts about the way society works or doesn't work for you? I mean, you said you were living in a car park. I mean, surely, you know, we're the seventh richest country in the world. Can't we make sure everyone's got somewhere to live?
You'd have thought so. But...
And well, something's going wrong, isn't it? I mean, have you got any thoughts, any kind of vision? Because I think this is what, everyone's looking from musicians particularly, is, look, hey, guys, here's something positive to say, and there's something
I have much optimism.
No?
No.
Quite negative, quite pessimistic. What? So how do you see the future then?
I try not to.
God. I think that's actually probably fair to say. There's a lot of young people in the same, exactly the same view. I mean, certainly young people I speak to. We've got the largest proportion of unemployed in the 16 to 24-year-olds we've had for 25 years. If you want to get out of that and into university, you're going to have to end up with a massive debt. Patrick, maybe we could have something positive from you. What can we do about this?
Well, we need to inspire the rich. We need to inspire the people that have. If you are rich and you have a second home, and that's how second home is empty most of the year, then those people who have second homes could be inspired to open up those second homes to to people to live in them for free. Big companies that have so much food that are selling that food for profit, and then they have to throw that food away because they haven't made the profit that they want. They could give that food away before they incinerate it. There's so many ways where big companies and wealthy people and governments and countries could help each other. The problem is that we love greed. We are greedy as a species, but we can choose not to be.
Adam, what about songwriting and actually getting songs together? How does that work as a group? Do you get one person do it, or is it you do it all together, or what?
Usually one person will go and write a song and come and share it with everyone else, and then everyone will try and put some sort of musical accompaniment to it.
It starts with effectively a bit of poetry, does it? And so, what inspires, what gets you, floats your boat when it comes to actually getting a song off the ground?
Usually a really bad day. that'll do it.
Patrick, what about you?
So many things. So it could be anything. A line, a word, an angry interaction with somebody, a beautiful girl, a pretty flower, a mountain. It could be anything.
Because I know a lot of us have these little moments of clarity, don't we? But how do you actually go about capturing that? Because I think sometimes you think, oh yeah, I had a moment of clarity earlier on today, but I can't remember quite what it was. Do you actually do things like carry notebook around, or that sort of thing to try and capture those thoughts?
I've got lots of notebooks with multiple scribbles. I vomit up rhymes. That's what I do. I vomit up too much rhymes, and then I reduce that massive vomit of words to a song. That's how I do it.
What about the music industry generally? Have you been offered anything like recording contracts or anything like that? Have you scratched the surface of the big, the music industry itself?
I don't really trust it. I just don't trust much of it. There's not really that much to trust. We were offered this and we've been offered that, but there's nothing concrete that I trust.
But if you were offered something, was it a contract, or did you actually get a chance to have a look at it?
Offered us the world and then they didn't meet us.
Oh,
we
really?
Said we'd meet you face to face.
Tell us about that. That's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? So someone's promised you the world and then didn't turn up.
Just some company that's only via email. A lot of people talk rubbish. Yeah. And they say that they want this and they want you to do that and they want you to do that, and they offer you the world. And they whatever the problem was, they didn't meet us. We went and busked and said that we were going to be there, and then they weren't there. They phoned us later to say, oh, we missed you. And I wasn't willing to waste another day. We went on to the next town to earn our living.
Well, fair enough, yeah. How do you actually manage to make a living doing this?
We just sing songs on the street and tell people that they shouldn't be greedy and that they should give to buskers and homeless people. And funny, when you tell somebody to tell them that they're being greedy, then they feel that they should give.
Do they not just think, shuffle on?
I see lots of buskers, especially in Bristol, that are incredibly talented and they are singing songs that are really beautiful, and I watch the passers-by pass by like it's background music, that it isn't something that they should offer anything for. And I see us on the street and verbally making comedy and creating a scene and asking people directly to not be greedy and help us on our way, and people are generous.
No, I mean, this does contrast quite a lot with Adam with TV. I don't know if you ever watch TV. A lot of us don't. But I mean, the culture that we're getting pushed out by the mainstream media really doesn't seem to gel with the kind of thing you're doing.
What you mean, like X Factor stuff? Is that what you mean? Well, yeah. Well, people like to watch, since Jeremy Beadle, isn't it? Jeremy Beadle days, they just like to watch failure. They like to watch something go wrong. And they like to watch somebody being embarrassed on a microphone, on loads of cameras, in front of thousands of people. And there might be a couple of really good singers in amongst it. But I think the masses are actually looking and excited about the worst case scenarios that might happen. And therefore, it's not about music. It's more about a show of pointing fingers and laughing at people and not being inspired by music. And I don't really watch telly or follow it or listen to the radio, for that matter.
You won't be listening to this, then.
No.
Also, I suppose the other essential thing is, how do people follow what you're doing? Because I mean, the chances of just coming across you in a West Country town, Adam, are pretty slim, aren't they?
We've got a Facebook and we post our travels up on there, where we go from place to place. And yeah, otherwise the rest is left to chance. But we're not just restricted to the southwest. We went up as far as Newcastle, and we hope to go even further later in the year.
And so you're actually managing to do this on the donations people give you in the street?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So you, have you got a website, anything like that? YouTube channels, this kind of thing that people can track you down on?
You can find us on Bandcamp. We sell our songs. You can listen to it and buy the songs or donate what you want. On a Bandcamp, it's a musician-friendly website.
What about old-fashioned CDs?
We make CDs and we sell them on a donation basis.
Oh, fantastic. So wherever you are, okay. I'm sure you'll be back in Bristol soon, will you?
We're busking tomorrow somewhere in town, and I think Bath the next day, and then not sure. We're busking the next 3 or 4 days. In this area.
Okay, well, Patrick Shevlin and Adam Whitaker from Fat Bollard, P-H-A-T, that is, Fat Bollard, B-O-L-L-A-R-D. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect, and we'll leave you with a song from your latest album, which is...
Spare a Little Change.
And that one's called Breathing Is Bad For You.
Yes.
Breathing is bad for you. What will we do when the skies are black and the rivers too, and they're printing out food? No need for cash. Your skin's all covered in a Glasgow-Smith rash. You'll be laughing about the old days. We got trashed in rain. Now seas and the oceans are polluted with our potions and the plastic pillfish who eat rubber. Everyone seems to look like each other. Have you had those dreams? You come from one mother. Now the powers that be, let us all smoke weed. And you can buy your tax-free flavours in an art of duty-free. You can see who are the ravers by the ones who have no teeth, with the children eating quavers soaked in LSD. Now the times have changed, people say, when all the money went. The times have changed, people say, yes, still the coppers are bent. And now they're raging through the country, they're chasing the next slums to find the humble people who refuse the idea and plan. Cabin crew calling, this planet slowly falling, where everyone is hoping that one day we'll all see morning. But the skies are black and the rivers too, since fracking polluted the rain and the food. Skies are black and the rivers too, now breathing is bad for you. Yeah, the new drug everyone is taking makes you live much longer. Where the cannabis cured the cancer and the people grew much stronger. Sadness in the eyes is clear as everybody cries. Black tears, there is no rich, there is no poor, no war, no bombing like before. For every waking hour is taken up with sorrow. The future you can borrow, your children pay the cost. Farming people to make power turns the people sour. Everybody lost. We'll be right back.
that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Fat Bollard, that's P-H-A-T, Bollard, and Steve Keane the Economist. Also, Vince McCann and his Ouija board. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Just contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. And I'll leave you with some tunes from Wiltshire's finest photographer and singer, Bob Naylor.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. And we come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. And we come to work the grounds in common and to make the wastelands grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. And they made the laws to chain us well. And the clergy dazzled us with heaven, or they damned us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. And we work to knead together, we need no swords. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent unto the lords. For we are free, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the man of property the orders came. They sent the hired men and the troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We came in peace, the orders came to cut them down. They came in peace, the orders came to cut them down. Oh, born in the middle of the afternoon in a horse-drawn wagon on the old A5. The Big 12, we shook my bed. You can't stop here, the policeman said. You better get born in someplace else. Get along, move along, get along, move along. Go, move, shift. All born a Tatey lift in time in an oboe tent by a Tatey field. Farmer said, the work's all done, it's time that you were moving on. You better get born in someplace else. Get along, move along, get along, move along. Go, move, shift. All born on a common near a building site where the field was rutted by the trailer's wheels. Local people said to me, oh, lower the price of property. You better get born in someplace else. Get along, move along, get along, move along. Go, move, shift. Oh, born at the back of a blackthorn hedge when the white hoar frost lay all around. Oh, Eastern kings came bearing gifts instead. The order came to shift. You better get born in someplace else. Get along, move along, get along, move along. Go, move, shift.
Oh, the eastern skies hung bright with stars, but one shone brighter than the rest. Those wise men came so stern and strict and brought the order to evict. You better get born in someplace else. Get along, move along, get along, move along. Go, move, shift. Oh, wagon, tent or trailer born this year, last year or in far off days. Born here or 1,000 miles away, there's always men nearby who say, you better get born in someplace else. Get along, move along, get along, move along. Go, move, shift. They call it the law, apartheid, internment, conscription, partition and silence. It's the law that they made to keep you and me where they think we belong. They live behind steel and bulletproof glass, machine guns and spies, and tell us who suffer the tear gas and torture that we're in the wrong. No time for love if they come in the morning, no time to show fear or for tears in the morning, no time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. The wail of the siren is the cry of the morning. The trade union leaders, the writers, the rebels, the fighters and all, and the strikers who fought with the cops at the factory gate, the sons and the daughters of unnumbered heroes who paid with their lives, and the poor folk whose class or creed or belief was their only mistake. No time for love if they come in the morning, no time to show fear or for tears in the morning, no time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. The wail of the siren is the cry of the morning. The boys in blue are only a few of the everyday cops on their beat. The CID branchmen, the spies and informers do their jobs well. Behind them, the men who tap phones, take pictures and program computers and file. And the ones who tell them when to come and take you to a cell. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or for tears in the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. The wail of the siren is the cry of the morning. They took away Sacco, Vanzetti, Connolly and Pierce in their time. And they came for Newton and Seal and the Panthers and some of their friends. In Boston, Chicago, Saigon, San Diego, Cape Town and Belfast. And places that never made headlines, the list never ends. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or for tears in the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. The wail of the siren is the cry of the morning. So come all you people and give to your sisters and brothers the will to fight on. They say you get used to a war, that doesn't mean the war isn't on. The fish need the sea to survive just like your people do. And the death squads can only get to them if first they can get through to you. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or for tears in the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. The wail of the siren is the cry of the morning.